Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel. The all-new Opel Mokka. With a new visor front face and pure panel interior, this is Opel.
But first, G7 leaders are meeting today in Cornwall in England, while a full summit of the British-Irish Council also takes place in Enniskillen, County Fermanagh. It follows a week of heightened tensions surrounding the Northern Ireland Brexit protocol, with Foreign Affairs Minister Simon Coveney describing spin and fog from London on the issue. Well, I'm joined now by the European Commissioner, Mairead McGuinness. Mairead, good morning to you.
Good morning, Damien.
I first want to focus on issues surrounding Brexit. How significant has the US intervention this week and Joe Biden's comments in particular in relation to the Northern Ireland Protocol, how significant has that been?
Well, I think the view and the support of the US for the peace process has been significant in the past. I think more so now because of the lack of implementation of the protocol and the increased tensions around what's happening in Northern Ireland. So I think when you hear that the President of the United States, and I dare say he had a word with the Prime Minister on these issues, and they both had an agreed statement about their commitment to the Belfast Agreement and the peace process, it does help. But you're right in saying that tensions are very strained at the moment. I think the word trust has been used quite a bit, and it's in very short supply. My colleague Vice President Maroš Šefčovič is a former diplomat and really has worked in this area, and even his patience I think is at this stage quite strained around what's happening, or indeed what's not happening around implementing the protocol. And I suppose if you go back to when it was agreed, and indeed the path to agreeing it was so difficult, you're going back to the autumn of 2019, and this is summer of 2021, and we're still having a conversation about non-implementation of an international treaty. And I think we all know there were teething problems and difficulties, and that's why grace periods were given and agreed by the European Union. I think the first breach of faith was when the UK had a meeting, Lord Frost had a meeting with Maroš Šefčovič, and I think the next day went out and unilaterally declared that he would extend those grace periods. So I think from then it's been quite difficult for the European Union to try and emphasise to the United Kingdom that if you sign a treaty, you are really obliged to implement it. And that's what we are trying to do, while at the same time addressing the issues that businesses are dealing with and trying to find flexibilities. And where we have proposed solutions, we have not found a positive answer, in particular around plant and animal checks. And, a lot of people, including the Ulster Farmers Union, have said if we had those checks in place, there would be less difficulties around goods coming in from the United Kingdom.
You mentioned there Commissioner Šefčovič and his comments this week in relation to retaliatory action if Britain could not, I suppose, commit to the Northern Ireland Protocol. Is that helpful language? Is that inflammatory language at this stage to be talking about retaliatory action?
I don't think it is inflammatory at all. I think what we have all been trying to do is, stay calm, talk to our UK counterparts, get them to understand that we are abiding by our side of this international treaty, and we expect them to do the same. We also need, as an EU27, to make sure that the United Kingdom understands where we are coming from, and the members, the member states of the European Union, want all of these agreements, which have happened because of Brexit, to be implemented, because they were agreed. It's not as if we put the pen into the hand of Lord Frost and insisted he sign something that he didn't negotiate. Quite the opposite. I know colleagues here in Brussels were telling me that it was negotiated line by line, word by word. So there is no sense of us wanting to, increase tensions. But equally, we have to be very firm about our requirements, which is around the sensitivities of Northern Ireland and the island of Ireland and around the single market. And we're doing no more than we have agreed with our UK counterparts. What we're finding from the UK side ever since, and I think before the ink was dry, that while they acknowledge that they signed up for this, I think it was more in theory than in practice. Mm. And what we're asking for is the practice.
But could the EU extend, under what conditions would the EU say to the UK, we are happy to allow you extend this grace period, this transition period, beyond the 30th of June? What sort of a commitment would they need to give you to allow that to happen?
Well, I think those will be chats that will be had and negotiations to be done between Maroš Šefčovič and his UK counterparts. So at this stage, we're not looking at what are the conditions. But what we have been asking and repeatedly trying to get the United Kingdom to do is engage with the details that we have presented around a number of issues, at least four or five. And we're not getting that engagement. And I suppose there is a sense of frustration as well that we've had to read headlines or opinion pieces in the UK press, which are directly opposite to the facts as we know them and the reality of our position. And I think that it's really important for us to stress that we cannot be pushed around in this way, that we are very, you know, straight players in this. We want this resolved and we want to dilute tensions in Northern Ireland. We want the Northern Ireland economy and citizens in Northern Ireland to benefit from its rightful place in the UK market and its additional access to the market, the large market of the European Union.
Yeah, and I think the Daily Telegraph yesterday, for example, in telling Joe Biden to butt out with his anti-British, anti-Brexit rhetoric is an example of what you're talking about there. But in saying that and in referencing that, Commissioner, John Bruton was the former Taoiseach and Fine Gael leader was on the News at One yesterday, more or less suggesting that possibly Boris Johnson and the Brexiteers and the hardcore Tories believe, you know, they've taken a political calculation that they want to see their members and their voters want to see Britain continuing to play hardball with the EU. Do you agree?
Well, I did listen to the former Taoiseach John Bruton, and certainly, I mean, he was very strong in his perception of what's happening. I mean, there is no doubt that in the British media, I mean, bureaucrats in Europe particularly, you know, get a bad press. And it does seem that it feeds into support for the government when there is this attack on the Brussels bureaucracy. Now, we can take that on the chin and that's fine. But we're also here and we're straight and we're trying to deal here with a situation that has arisen because of Brexit. And I think sometimes in the narrative, people are comparing the protocol implementation with pre-Brexit realities, which, you know, included no mention of border. In fact, borders were removed because of the European Union. So we never had that issue. So I think when somebody of the stature of John Bruton makes those comments, you cannot really pull back from them. He has, you know, he's quite mild normally on these things, but he reads this as a political calculation. Now, from my side, whatever it is, it's not working. And I think we consistently at the EU level have said, look, we signed this, you signed it. We have to work out the difficulties for businesses in Northern Ireland, the complications around pets and animal tagging and all of these issues. And, you know, ironically, and you will have more details on this from your area of speciality, you know, the whole animal and food chain issues arose. We have a fantastic system of traceability in the European Union because of BSE, which arose in the United Kingdom, and the UK were part and parcel of this fantastic system of food safety and all of the protections. And what we're asking the UK to do now, if they're serious about this and trying to resolve the difficulties for their businesses in Northern Ireland, is to accept, and we will accept it on a temporary basis, that they align with the plant and animal health checks. And that would at least give us space and time to resolve the complexities. Truth is this, and I'll finish on this point. In 2019, when this was signed up to, there was a lot of time given for the UK government to allow businesses to adjust and give them the information they needed. That was not done. The preparation was not done. If you look at what the Irish government did with businesses in Ireland, because it's not easy for Irish businesses, this whole Brexit saga, but there was preparation. There were reality checks and businesses were given the time and space and support financially to adjust. I'm afraid when it came to Northern Ireland, the UK government just didn't do that.
Okay, just a final one on this before we move on. Nigel Dodds of the DUP was on Newsnight last night, and he obviously accepted that a border between the North and the Republic could destabilise the Good Friday Agreement, and there's obvious reasons for that, the political sensitivities of a physical border, even if it's just for customs checks. We know the impact that that would have, we'll say, on nationalists in Northern Ireland and indeed people in the South as well. But he was making the point that a border down the Irish Sea, which separates Northern Ireland from GB, that it has equal potential of sensitivities among the loyalist and unionist communities. Now, there is There was talk earlier this week of a report swirling around the EU that maybe if the EU does get fed up with all of this, that we could have a situation where goods travelling from the island of Ireland in across EU borders, other member states, obviously the other 26, that they would be subject to checks. That would be tantamount, to use that phrase, of throwing Ireland under the bus. Do you think that that could possibly happen? Because, you know, while we are very wound up here, obviously, and you as being an Irish person in the commission there, we understand the sensitivities of what's going on here. But for an awful lot of other member states, there are bigger fish to fry. There are bigger issues that need dealing with. So is there a fear that the support and among member states and from the commission for Ireland in all of this, that it might wear thin if the UK continues to hold its ground?
Well, a categorical no to that. And I think you underestimate the support, the sensitivities, the awareness, not just in member states, but in the European Parliament on the Irish question. And, you know, recently I was quite taken aback. A German MEP that I've worked with for a long time, and we were discussing this issue. He was in the Parliament when John Hume and indeed Ian Paisley were members of the European Parliament. And he got very emotional. And he's not a man of much emotion, I have to say, because he said, you know, we worked hard for peace in Northern Ireland. And I think what's very disappointing is that there's now a suggestion that the European Union doesn't care. The European Union is a peace project. It cares deeply. Mm-hmm. So I do not at all have that concern that you have. But could I just say that you mentioned Nigel Dodds, and if I recall correctly, when Theresa May proposed a solution which would have avoided all of these problems we're now talking about, as far as I understood it, the DUP rejected that. The DUP, of course, voted for Brexit. They rejected a good solution. And their government, and they had great faith in Boris Johnson, agreed to the protocol. It seems extraordinary to me that in 2019 that these conversations were not happening with elected representatives, not just the unionist or loyalist communities, but all representatives on the island of, or rather in Northern Ireland, so that they would understand the consequences of the protocol. So I think that, you know, we'll have these back and forths and who said and she said and what happened next. The truth is now, there is an agreement, an international treaty. There's also a trade and cooperation agreement. In my area of financial services, we have much work to do. So we can either get stuck in the past mm-hmm. or treat each other as we are, equals, and work out the problems where we can solve them and allow businesses and communities in Northern Ireland to benefit from the access they enjoy to the UK market unfettered and to the European Union market. And frankly, a lot of businesses are already seeing that, notwithstanding some of the complexities.
All right, Commissioner, moving on to that area you say, which is under your watch now, financial services, and the G7 nations have backed a move which could see the introduction of a global minimum corporation tax of 15%, which of course would undercut Ireland's situation, which Pascal Donoghue, the finance minister, is estimated could cost the Irish economy 2 billion euros. Is that a figure that's accurate, do you believe, and need we just get ready for this inevitability?
No, I listened very carefully to Minister Donoghue this morning, and I've heard that figure before, and I dare say his services have produced accurate figures in order to prepare for what might happen. I mean, there's a few points here. I think the whole world is changed and was changing anyway, but COVID has accelerated a sense in which during the pandemic, there were some corporates who had a very good pandemic in terms of profitability, and a sense in which, because of various different tax rules globally, that some big entities can avoid paying what is regarded as a fair share of tax. And I think that's coming from citizens as well as NGOs and others. What happened with the G7, I think, is significant, but that followed also an announcement by the US that they would look at a tax rate of 21%, although in the G7 that was reduced to 15%. So in my view, there is a direction of travel here mm-hmm. around how big corporates are treated. Of course, there will be a lot of work needed to be done at the OECD level, because the big seven can't dictate for large, small and medium. But there's no doubt that there is a concern about those who can avoid paying a fair share of tax. When I listened to the minister, I mean, clearly he is preparing for a potential reduction in corporate tax. But as he is obliged to do, he is looking after the interests of Ireland in terms of making the case for tax competition. But there are lots of views around the table here in the European Union around tax. There was the CCTB, that consolidated tax-based proposal, still on the table, but likely to be withdrawn shortly because there will be other proposals coming forward. And in addition, in relation to taxation, Europe has just borrowed $750 billion to, you know, kickstart our economies and the green and digital transformation. And we're looking at digital tax to try and repay, and also around climate, a carbon border adjustment tax. So on the tax issue, there's going to be a huge amount of activity.
Commissioner, another area you'll be very familiar with is agriculture. And within the next hour, farmers will be protesting in towns across the country. It's been organised by the IFA. There's a lot of disquiet, a lot of concern, a lot of worry wrapped up in relation to the future of the Common Agricultural Policy and what lies in store there in terms of direct payments to farmers. And obviously the big ticket issue, which is climate change, and the fact that agriculture will certainly be at the front of dealing with Ireland meeting its climate targets. Now, farmers are very worried and they're very concerned on a range of issues in those areas. They also feel that they are being left behind a little bit by the Commission, that the Commission have imposed a stick rather than carrot attitude towards getting farmers and food producers to actually comply with rules and regulations to reduce carbon emissions by 2030. And they feel that they're not getting the proper supports from EU level to deal with that. Are you aware of these concerns?
Look, I live on a farm whenever I can get back to Ireland, and I understand farming and I've worked with farmers. I think there are two issues here. The previous CAP reform, I was one of the negotiators, so in 2011, that proposal. And the issue of convergence, which is, in other words, that we would take money from some farmers with high payments and would move to others, that was muted and started way back then, as was, if you like, the greening of the Common Agriculture Policy, so more money for environmental. And that, you know, if you like, train has left the station, and these reforms, which are in their 11th hour now in terms of conclusion, have, if you like, picked up on those two issues. What has happened, and I think is regrettable in all of the discussions and equally around climate, is that there is a sense in the agriculture community that they are being, if you like, blamed and they're not being supported. And I think there is a very divisive debate between farmers and environmentalists, which shouldn't exist because they should be on the same side. When it comes to the Commission's support, this proposal that's currently in the last stages was brought forward by the former Agriculture Commissioner, Phil Hogan. It failed to reach any agreement in the last parliamentary mandate, where I was still a member of parliament. And it's now, it has to be agreed because farmers need certainty. And I would ask farmers, you know, I can understand their concern because I live in an agriculture community, but there are opportunities too from addressing climate change. There is already research that Chagas has undertaken around reducing your inputs and not reducing your production. I suppose if you've been a generation or if you've been decades a farmer where you were talked about producing, it's hard then to maybe readjust and think we have to look at producing with nature in mind. And, you know, I have rows at home with he who occasionally must be obeyed about why don't you just leave things alone in the corner of a field rather than, you know, give space for nature. Mm-hmm. Lots of farmers are doing this. So I can understand the tension and the anxiety amongst farmers. But when it comes to convergence, you know, Ireland kept payments very differentiated much longer than any other member state. I said on radio to your predecessor, Sean O'Rourke, in 2011, this would be the most divisive farming issue. And I was right, unfortunately, because farmers are divided. Yeah. Neighbour against neighbour, farm organisation against farm organisation. And critically, the voice of farming is fragmented. And that is something that I think farmers need to think long and hard about.
Okay. What is the EU's attitude towards Ireland's mandatory hotel quarantine rules? And when do you think we should lift that and begin, I suppose, opening up the country to international travel again?
Well, as far as I know, the mandatory quarantine rules have stopped. So I hope live on air that I'm not giving incorrect information, because there was a question, a big question raised by the Commission about the imposition of those rules. I'll give you an example, because if you're coming from Belgium to Ireland when those rules were in place, you would have to quarantine for 2 weeks in a hotel. And what happened? There were no flights from Belgium to Ireland because why would anyone put on a flight? And to be fair, Ryanair is the only what's the airline that are actually servicing this market, and Ryanair have reinstated flights. So there was a, you know, questions asked, and the Irish did come back and replied to those. So I hope I'm not giving false information, but you know, there is now the move away from that quarantine. Look, on COVID, you know, it's been a difficult journey for everybody, and I get messages from people who want to reconnect with families and can't do it, and it's really, really upsetting. But look how far we've come. I mean, I was talking to a sibling of mine who's younger, who's had her double vaccine, and I'm glad for her. Mm. And if you look at Ireland in terms of vaccination rates, we're kind of global leaders. So from a very difficult start, and I had conversations on this program about that, we now have a very good situation, but we still clearly have concerns around these new variants.
But should we, as the EU, begin looking to poorer countries? Because we're not all safe until everybody is safe. And the rollout, obviously, in poorer countries outside the EU is extremely slow. What is the EU going to do in that regard?
Well, what the EU has done, and I think this has got lost in the noise, and President Ursula von der Leyen, in the difficult moments where we were not being praised for our initial rollout of vaccination when they were in short supply, she committed to the COVAX mechanism to get vaccines to the developing world and committed significant amounts of money to that. But I'll give you some interesting figures. The European Union has produced 700 million vaccines. 350 million have been exported to many, many countries. But, you know, the president of the Commission was one of the loudest voices at the very start, in the midst of all the heat and anger about who was producing and what was happening. And she said very clearly, and was supported by the College of Commissioners, don't look inward, look globally. Because as you rightly said, Damien, if we only look after ourselves, it's a fool's paradise, because the rest of the world needs support. I think the difficult question is, should we vaccinate our children or should we vaccinate healthcare workers in third countries? And the World Health Organization has been very firm on this. Glad to see what's happening now. The US is coming on board, but the US and the UK, you know, they initially ring-fenced their production. They didn't export. And whatever criticism the European Union took in the beginning, at least we continue to export. Yeah. And we allowed others to have the benefits of an incredible rollout of vaccination. And, you know, I think we're kind of, I hope we'll remember how difficult this was when COVID hit, and how different it is now, and how we take for granted basic freedoms.
Sure.
One thing I was saying yesterday to a colleague, we were talking about a conference on the future of Europe. Maybe we need to remind each other that the freedom of movement is so fundamental, and you only appreciate it when it's gone.
Well, just on that, going back to the hotel quarantine, while it was in place here, the feeling was, Commissioner, that we damaged diplomatic relations with the rest of the EU because we were, I suppose, almost imprisoning their citizens when they arrived here for a couple of weeks at a time. Will the EU and other countries, will they forget that easily?
Oh yeah. I mean, I know we have a paranoia sometimes about damage and what people think of us and whatever. You know, we're a group of 27 member states. Sometimes we disagree with one another, but we don't bear grudges. We debate, we argue. I mean, I always said that the value of the European Union is not that we agree on everything, is that we disagree on many things, but we have the capacity to find a solution. So there's been a warm welcome to the relaxation of the mandatory quarantine. And you know, the truth, as I pointed out, was that, and it is an issue for Ireland to think very carefully about, how do we, as an island nation, restore our flights? The airline industry, in my view, is in a really difficult position. I mean, not that it matters to me. I live in Brussels most of the time now. But, you know, it's quite concerning for many people that they don't have the connectivity. And indeed, from a business point of view. And again, for those, you know, who work in the airline industry, I mean, it has been a devastating time, and it is unlikely to recover to the pre-COVID levels for some considerable time.
Okay. Finally, Commissioner, I know you're somewhat removed from national politics for quite some time now, but you do keep a close ear to what's going on here. You've referenced that already by saying you've been tuned into various programmes here. So you can't have missed the story in relation to the political polling controversy. Did you or any of your campaign teams ever use fake business cards to hide the fact that you were collecting information on behalf of Fine Gael when you were running for Europe and indeed for the Dáil?
Well, I certainly did not. I was totally unaware of this until I listened in, as you said, to this story that has happened. And I hope that nobody who helped me on my campaigns would have done it. I think in a European election campaign, it probably wouldn't even be appropriate because it's a vast constituency. But at the end of the day, and I think all the political parties who engaged in this, including Fine Gael, have been very clear. Yes, they used it and they've stopped. Rightly so.
Is it damaging for the parties involved? Is it damaging for the body politic to hear that people are using fake ID to gather information from ordinary innocent people at the doorstep? Without being too emotional about it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say there's no ordinary innocent Irish person when it comes to politics. And if I was not a politician, and I wasn't for some time, and somebody came to my door and said they were from X party, they'd probably know the look in my eye whether I was going to vote for them or not. They wouldn't need to show a card. But I think, look, the world has moved on a bit. And I think there is now a kind of concern around information and privacy, and rightly so. So I don't think that the tactics of the past, although some was quite recent past, are appropriate for the future. But I'll tell you one thing that I was aware of, and maybe it happened in my case, but I didn't see the proof. There was often a trial, if you like, to put two candidates of the same party against each other. And that would be done by somebody finding the results of a poll, a local poll that would, you know, as you know, Damien, hit the local newspapers. And by God, was there tension, not between parties, but within parties. It was quite explosive. But yeah, it usually worked because it made us work harder.
It did indeed. And you know all about that from your first European campaign back in 2004, 2005. All right, we're going to leave it there. Commissioner Mairead McGuinness, thank you very much indeed. And we will be talking more about that issue after this short break.
Text 51551 today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.